I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if out my heart I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down.
Good morning. I'm Karanja Carroll, Associate Professor of Black Studies at SUNY New Paltz.
And I'm Alexandra Cox, Assistant Professor of Sociology at New Paltz. We're the newest members of the Prison Voices Project Collective.
Today, we talk with Deborah Small, Executive Director of Break the Chains, a nonprofit policy reform advocacy organization committed to creating awareness and incubating action groups dedicated to promoting public health alternatives for communities disproportionately affected by punitive drug policies, about current issues in racism, criminalization, and punishment. Like many of us, she's been noticing the ways that conservatives and libertarians from Newt Gingrich to Rand Paul are now interested in prison reform. Just this week, Democratic Cory Booker teamed up with libertarian Rand Paul to introduce a criminal justice reform bill in Congress.
Break the Chains has been at the forefront of campaigns for sentencing reform, alternatives to incarceration, repeal of post-conviction civil sanctions for drug offenses, expanding needle exchange and other effective harm reduction practices, addressing racially disparate law enforcement practices, and expanding access to effective drug treatment outside the criminal justice system. Deborah is recognized as an international expert on issues concerning U.S. drug policies, particularly their impact on women and people of color. She was previously the Director of Public Policy and Community Outreach at the Drug Policy Alliance, a national drug policy reform organization, and the Legislative Director at the New York Civil Liberties Union. She has her J.D. and Master's in Public Policy from Harvard.
The first segment of our interview with Deborah Small contextualizes the social, political, and historical context of current struggles around criminalization, policing, and incarceration. She begins by connecting the hunger strikes taking place in California state prisons over the last 3 years to the inability of prison reformers to address the political underpinnings of incarceration.
I think that's really great. It's funny that, you know, I love history and stuff. Alexandra, uh-huh. I always have. And I just finished watching this documentary about the uprising in Attica.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was really remarkable to me that I had forgotten about was the amount of support that the Attica prisoners had in the community at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, you know, way down in the city, hundreds mm-hmm. of miles away, there were literally hundreds of thousands of, you know, hundreds and mm-hmm. thousands of people who turned out in support of them, mm-hmm. who were following what was happening to them. And I just compared that to what happened out here in California this year around the hunger strike mm-hmm. and what occurred to me as general indifference, mm-hmm. even within the progressive community. You know, I would be on calls with other people, you know, who were progressive lawyers or whatever, talking about issues. And, you know, no one would even raise the issue of the fact that there was a hunger strike going on in the prisons across California. And I was like, wow, how could that have just so fallen off of our radar screen, particularly given that the numbers of people in prison now are so much greater than they were at the time of Attica. But to me, that has a lot to do with the ways in which punishment has become normalized in our culture, you know, and our conversation about who the people are, and the whole concept of political prisoners has gotten lost, you know, even within the progressive community. And particularly that's come up for me in relationship to the conversation that we're in now around criminal justice reform, because I feel that the story that's being told by the reform community, not just the opposition, but by the reform community about how we got to where we are, undermines the goals of changing it in the ways that most of us say we want it changed. So if you see the proliferation of imprisonment as somehow a legitimate, if misguided, response to increasing crime, then you see the efforts at reform as being a correction of that legitimate but misguided response. But if you see the increase in incarceration as an intentional response to urban rebellion, to the demand for restructuring, for organizing in communities that had previously been kept quiescent, then you have a different response to what's needed in terms of reform and what role the system has played all along. And you don't see incremental ameliorative efforts as being as actually being legitimate efforts to undermine what was done quite intentionally before. And so it bothers me because I'm old enough to remember that the first wave of people who went to prison were not drug offenders. They were political prisoners. They were people who were organizing in the community. They were people who were part of the urban rebellion of the 60s that our government decided that they wanted to neutralize. That was the first wave of people. Then the second wave, it became around drugs and gangs, etc. When I was growing up, Black folks did not consider themselves Black. They didn't call themselves Black. They didn't associate themselves with Africans. If you wanted to insult somebody, you would call them Black and woolly head, etc. I mean, it's hard to remember that, but I remember when Black men still used to count their hair, you know, and part of what changed that, I believe, was the experience around Brown v. Board and the experiments that Dr. Clark did with the dolls, where Black people got to see the direct harm that our internalized racism was causing our children. And I don't think that it's a coincidence that 10 years after Brown, you saw the emergence of a Black nationalist and a Black consciousness movement that was specific about us embracing those things that we had previously rejected and owning our Africanness, you know, and having that and being proud of that heritage.
Deborah continues by discussing the connections between political prisoners, the war on drugs, and the current political underpinnings of incarceration.
But it's like, if you don't see that connection, then you don't actually see the political and economic role that imprisonment plays and continues to play, and that the things that we call reform now don't do anything to undermine the role that punishment continues to play with respect to poor people and people of color.
We are talking with Deborah Small, Executive Director of Break the Chains. Alexandra shared with me your article, Cause for Trepidation, Libertarians' Newfound Concern for Prison Reform. And that pretty much shapes some of the questions that we wanted to talk through with you and have you expand on some insight. So I guess if we could start with you trying to explain why you introduced the concept of mass criminalization as a way to understand the current discourse on crime and punishment?
Well, so let me just start by saying that I've been in the criminal justice reform field for a long time, about 15 years now. And one of the things that I've noticed is that we tend to have cycles of work that focus around the issue of the day. So, for example, 6 or 7 years ago, or maybe even 10 years ago when Bush was in office, well, even going further, when I first came into the field, the issue of the day was drug courts. Mm-hmm. They were the new reform that everyone was embracing as a way that was going to correct some of the problems of the justice system. Then a few years later, when Bush came into office, it was reentry was the issue in vogue because he was concerned about reentry issues. And so the whole field became focused on doing reentry work. And even though we didn't do anything to change the policies that acted as barriers to people, we had all kinds of work focused on making it easier and developing more programs for people coming back from prison, etc. So then when Michelle Alexander's book came out, which I happen to think is brilliant, the new issue of the day has become mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. And so now the same people who focused on drug courts before and then reentry are now talking about mass incarceration. Each of those issues are legitimate, and each of them are an important part of the problem that's posed by the prison industrial complex. But they don't, to me, represent a sufficient frame for talking about policy reform and what it is that people who were concerned about changing institutions as opposed to fixing people should be thinking about and focused on. Mm-hmm. And so my major problem with mass incarceration is two things. One, as a word, it's problematic because it suggests, as a phrase, that somehow there's some level of incarceration that's okay before you get to mass incarceration. So I mean, because I also have issues like just as a wordsmithy person. Okay. So I have a problem with from that point of view. In the same way that I have a problem with the term majority minority, which is an oxymoron from my point of view that we should never use. So, you know, just as a person who cares about terminology, I don't like us to use that frame because it implies within it something that undermines the very thing that we say that we're trying to do. So that's the first thing.
Okay.
Secondly, is that it's like stop and frisk, which is only one small part of racially biased policing. So if you only focus on one small thing, which may be a big thing, but it's like the thread of a sweater. You can pull out a thread and you can make a hole in the sweater, but you still got a sweater. You just got a sweater with a lot of holes in it.
Right.
So to me, it's like the problem with mass incarceration is that it's focusing on the tail end of a long process, a process that for many people starts when they're children. So the reason that I prefer or use the phrase mass criminalization is because, one, to me, it's a more accurate term of what it is that we're doing, which is criminalizing large masses of people and doing it at very early stages, and not all of that criminalization results in people ending up in prison. But it does end up in them having some level of criminal justice contact or supervision, whether it's in the form of surveillance or a police arrest or their interaction with the family court or the child welfare system or the public public assistance system. I mean, there are all of these ways in which we have made it somewhat criminal for people to be poor, because that their very status of being poor subjects them to surveillance and intrusions on their life by the state that would never be tolerated by other people. And so to me, that's criminalization. If you have to surrender your urine as a condition to get money to feed your children or to pay your rent, then that's treating you like a criminal, because we don't do that to people who want to take a tax break on their mortgage.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
or get any number of other benefits that we regularly bestow on middle class people. Mm-hmm. And we would never think of subjecting them to that. We wouldn't even do it to the elderly as a condition before they could ride on the, you know, elderly assisted bus for transportation or to get meals on wheels or whatever. But we feel like it's okay to do it to poor people because, one, we assume that the majority of them are people of color. Mm. And two, we know that whether they are or not, they're people without power.
Right.
And because of the particular system that we live in, which is class-based, but in denial about it, everyone wants to have someone to look down on. So we focus our attention in terms of where we are down as opposed to up. Mm. You know, when we're looking for a scapegoat, we look for someone down mm-hmm. as opposed to up. And one of the basic values of being poor in the U.S. is that, well, at least I'm not undocumented. You know, mm-hmm. or at least I'm not behind bars. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always some other group that's going to have a little bit more stigma and a little less privileges and liberties than you that you can look down on. And that's a big part of, unfortunately, our country's identity, because we spend a lot of time focusing and obsessing about that.
And how do you think the criminal justice reform movement may have suffered by relying on the framework of mass incarceration?
Well, so I don't know if I would say suffer, mm-hmm. because a suffering implies that you would have gotten somewhere otherwise if you didn't. Mm. And, you know, I don't know that that's true. You know, our ability to move any issue is very, very limited, because ultimately these things aren't really about crime. They're really more about economic and social control under the guise of crime control. Because if we were really focused on crime, we would care as much about white-collar crime and the kind of crime that costs people millions and billions as we do the crimes that cost thousands. So I'm not convinced that this has much to do with crime at all. That being said, I think that the particular problem that the justice field faces, which is the same problem that the progressive community in general in America faces, is the overall unwillingness to deal with issues around racism and issues around capitalism. And that's not the same thing as talking about race, which mm-hmm. we'll talk about, but that's not the same as talking about racism and white privilege, mm-hmm. nor do we really want to deal with talking about capitalism, because people feel that they don't have a viable working alternative to it, so therefore they don't feel they can talk about it, which I find amazing, because it never stops the right. They do the most preposterous stuff, and it never bothers them that there's no factual basis for it whatsoever, or any example that their version of democratic rule could work anywhere, but they put it out there anyhow. So, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, a discussion about capitalism is the equivalent to that. But what I am saying is that because we tend to be ahistorical in our country, we forget that most of the major progressive gains in the U.S. for the majority of people were accompanied by a critique of the overall economic system, whether they were called critiques of capitalism or not. So both critiques of slavery, critiques of that led to the labor movement, to the women's movement, all talked about the inequality of the economic structure and the hierarchical nature of the economic structure and the way in which it unjustly enriched a small percentage of the people at the expense of everybody else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't include that in our education anymore, mm-hmm. but that doesn't make it any less true. Mm-hmm. And so for me, not seeing the role that criminal justice plays in maintaining that ongoing relationship of power and economic distribution in society means that you're actually missing the ball game.
I think, you know, piggybacking off of Alexander's question and getting at a point that you stated in the previous response, I'm curious to know, you know, what do you think are the pros and cons of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow? Obviously, it kind of pushed forward this language of mass incarceration, and it also shaped, you know, certain discussions within criminal justice as it relates to reform. But are there any other pros and cons that you might that you think generate out of that text and its popularity?
See, I don't blame her book for the frame that people are using. Her book is a book, and the title is the title. I think it's a perfect title for her book.
Mm.
I blame the field for using the title as a frame for doing policy work.
Okay.
That's on us. That's not on her.
Okay.
You know, any more than it's on us to be obsessed with marijuana reform, as if that was the most important issue in drug policy reform.
Okay.
Or to forget about the international aspects of the war on drugs and only focus on what happens in the U.S. borders. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying, and that's a lot in one sentence, responsive to what you said. But my point, basically, is that, one, I don't fault her. I think her book is an excellent book. That everything that she set out to do in the book, she accomplished. Okay?
Okay.
So no one book should be the basis of any social or political movement.
Correct.
No one book should be the basis for determining a policy frame for moving forward around any complex set of social justice issues. So for me, you know, I don't have any critiques of her book.
Okay.
I wish she had gone further in terms of giving some solutions, you know, that get to the heart of the need to dismantle drug prohibition. But the fact that she wasn't there when she wrote the book, I don't fault her for that either. I think that any time that you can forward a conversation that opens people's eyes about an issue that they need to be educated about, I think that that is a positive thing. And if you can do that in a way that communicates to a popular audience of people, I think that that's also great. I don't want to say academic because I'm not an academic. My analytical policy frame critique of the book, and it's not of the book, really. It's of the reception to the book. And the way in which it's been interpreted, and one of the reasons that it's popular, is that for me, I believe that one of the reasons that it struck a chord and is become popular and a bestseller, aside from the fact that it provides a lot of good information, is that it also tells a story that America is comfortable with, a story of Black victimology, a story of racial oppression and discrimination. And quite frankly, in and of itself, it's not a particularly empowering story.
Mm.
And it's a story that white people can read and get educated about and feel good about themselves because now they know about something that they didn't know about before, as if they had no complicity in the reality of the condition that she's talking about.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I don't blame her or the book for that. I think that that's the context in which most conversations about race take place in America. That it's a comfortable space.
Mm-hmm.
White people are willing, and for them, progress is we're now willing to accept the fact that we've done really bad things to Black people over the years and to feel bad about it.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, that represents progress. And to say that we're going to try not to do those same things again.
Mm.
And in the American context, that represents racial progress.
Right. We shifted to a focus on the role that progressives play in discussions of criminalization. In this segment, Deborah Small introduces the impact of what she calls the research industrial complex on impoverished communities.
Our conversation about race in America is also a regional conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the degree that you can have a conversation that, or it's a conversation about Black people versus the police.
Mm.
So if it's an urban conversation, it's very much about the police and the role of the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
If it's otherwise, it's Southerners in the role of the bad guys.
Mm.
But you rarely ever see a conversation that would have white progressive do-gooders in the role of the bad guys in the conversation about how racism gets perpetuated in urban settings.
Right.
Because the role that perpetual research plays in keeping that going. Because, you know, part of the prison social welfare industrial complex is the research industrial complex in which people get paid a lot more money to research stuff than the people who actually serve people or do something about it get paid.
Very true.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And if you say anything about that, that is the academic equivalent of heresy.
We're talking with Deborah Small, a leading thinker on the impact of the war on drugs and the war on crime on communities of color, who comments here on the role of litigation as a tool of social change.
I think one of the many negative lessons that people took from the period of the 50s and 60s and all of the progressive gains of that time was that we could actually litigate our way into justice. And I don't think it's that part of the issues that we're talking about are related to the fact that almost every major progressive social justice, racial justice, civil liberties group in the U.S. is run by lawyers.
Wow.
I mean, think about it. You can't name too much that aren't.
Right.
And while they don't all litigate primarily, they do tend to have a litigation-first approach to things. And the problem, and it's not that litigation is not valuable, but one, it's not a great tool for organizing.
Okay.
You know, you can use litigation to support an organizing campaign, but you can't really build an organizing campaign around litigation. And so I think people forget that Brown v. Board was in support of an ongoing campaign for desegregating schools. The cases were not the campaign.
Right.
The cases were in support of the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't actually organize that way. And so, you know, part of the consequence of having litigation-first strategies is that, you know, we don't have the foundation on the ground of people power, of people power organizing that has actually always been the backbone of any progressive movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part of that, which is even more serious to me, is the fact that that period of jurisprudence was actually an exception to the rule of American jurisprudence, which has been primarily conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the idea that you could continue to rely on having progressive courts to move forward a progressive agenda is flying in the face of reality.
Mm.
And this court that we have now pretty much set on dismantling everything that the previous progressive courts have done.
Mm-hmm.
So we're stuck with a litigation strategy going to courts that are progressively ruling against us on everything.
Would you consider a litigation-first approach reactionary?
No, I don't see it that way because I'm trained as a lawyer. And I became a lawyer because I believe that there's a role for lawyers in being a tool for moving forward, you know, social and progressive justice. It's just that they're a tool. They shouldn't be the leaders.
Right,
you
but
know, the law is a tool. And yes, anything that you do in law is by definition reactionary because it's operating within a particular system and construct.
Okay.
But that being said, in a democratic society, that's what you have.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the I'm thinking if there needs to be a movement that's on the ground when the litigation first approach is it's reacting to something within the larger society as opposed to coming up from the ground and then it being supported through the law. But
right. And I guess what I'm saying is that I think there's a role for litigation. It just shouldn't be litigation first.
Okay.
So if I look at a group that I think is using litigation well, I would point to the Advancement Project, which has been doing a lot of the litigation around voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
But they've also been doing a lot of on-the-ground organizing around voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've done a really good job of using their cases to educate the public about the threats to voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, I would just use that. And they're not the only example. It's just the one I could think of right now.
Okay.
But that a good example of using litigation in a way that's part of a broader campaign that, and a lot of the victories that they won were really important in holding back, you know, the implementation of many of those laws in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, I don't discount the importance of litigation in certain circumstances, but I think it should be part of a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be leading it. And in sentencing reform and in criminal justice, there really hasn't been enough of on-the-grounds movement building to support the work that's been done both legislatively
and courts to change or challenge the overall punishment construct.
Mm-hmm.
So another point that came up in your article, you state with an article, the education and criminal justice systems have become the principal tools for black subordination and economic exploitation. And I was just curious to know if the type of connection that you're making between education and corrections as being ways in which black folks are controlled, and then connecting that idea to the school-to-prison pipeline.
Well, I mean, I think the school-to-prison pipeline makes the connection better than I could. The fact that we have that term and that it's understood in our society says more than I could about the connection between education and criminal justice.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That we recognize that there is a direct pipeline funneling young people, primarily young people of color, out of schools and into jails is, like, pretty much understood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the point that I was trying to make with respect to libertarian politics and where we are is twofold. One is that there's an economic reason that we're doing this. You know, part of it is because these young people represent a labor force that we don't have jobs for.
Right.
And so prison and the military have become two major repositories for people that are basically unemployed and unemployable in the current economy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, since America is a racial caste system with the preferred position going to white people, in this case, the preferred position was the military, although many of them would question how much that was the preferred position, you know, to be in economically. But be that as it may, you know, there's a direct relationship. And, you know, I was reading just the other day about the fact that literally within this country, there are 660 schools in the country that produce the majority of school failure, the majority of school dropouts. They're almost all exclusively schools that are primarily serving Black and Latino youth in poor communities. And I guarantee you that if you went and compared the stats on how many of those kids end up filling those prisons in their states, you'll see that pipeline connection.
Mm-hmm. I think, Deborah, something that I've been struggling a lot with lately is in the context of young people, as a number of states, including and especially New York, have closed down a lot of their juvenile facilities, and there's been kind of across-the-board support for closing these facilities. There's been this process almost of kind of transcarceration. So facilities have opened up in New York City that are operated by nonprofit organizations, which house these kids, and they basically function as institutions of social control, and I think play out some of the same forces of criminalization that you're talking about. But progressives and Republicans alike say, look, we all agree we shouldn't lock people up. This is a victory. We're closing down facilities. And I sort of wondered about your take more broadly on this trend in the adult system and sort of how, if you could think forward 5 years, what you predict could be happening in this process of decarceration.
So I absolutely believe that we will see a trend towards decarceration. I wrote about that in that blog post, which I think would have happened anyway, in part because of the tremendous cost associated with locking people up.
Mm-hmm.
However, that doesn't mean that we have a commitment to invest in people. And I was thinking about it the other day, that there's not a single state in this country, including New York, California, et cetera, that pays welfare benefits for a family of four more in excess to the amount it spends on one person behind bars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, think about that. I mean, there's not a single state that puts people at the poverty level. Not right. one. The best we do is putting them 55 to 60% of the poverty level. But putting that to the side, when I thought about the fact that there is not one single state in this country that provides welfare benefits for four people in excess of what it spends on one person behind bars, that says so much mm-hmm. about our priorities. Mm-hmm. You know, it just mm-hmm. says so much about it. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's part of the reason why I am really focused on both changing the frame mm-hmm. away from incarceration to really talking about criminalization mm-hmm. and talking about the criminalization of poverty, because it doesn't really help people that much if we keep them out of prison just to saddle them with debts and community service burdens
Absolutely.
And all these other things that they can never meet.
Yeah, and I mean, in the youth justice system, what happens is that rather than reinvesting in communities, places like New York City invest in social workers to police the homes of kids and their parents who are system involved. So there's no actual reinvestment in people. It's just a reinvestment in social control, I think.
No, I agree. And part of it, to be honest, is because there are two particular conversations that we actually don't want to have on both the left or the right, you know, in this country. And so within the context of criminal justice, we have lots of conversations about the people that we label as criminal and why and what they've done, et cetera. No conversation at all about the people who are doing the labeling.
Mm. Absolutely. Yes.
What is that thing in us mm-hmm. that maintains the need to punish?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we the most punitive society
mm-hmm.
of all the major industrialized countries?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we hand out sentences to people like they're candy?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we disproportionately punish people who fall into one of two categories, either the rebellious or the unfortunate?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that to me is one of the essential questions that needs to be asked. I'm tired of focusing on fixing the people
mm-hmm.
who've already been beaten up by society and not talking about the people who are screwing them over. So that's the first thing. And the second conversation, similarly difficult but just as necessary, is the conversation that needs to take place within poor communities of color, is about their acceptance of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
The willingness to buy into the idea that somehow if mm-hmm. you extract a certain percentage of the population, mm-hmm. it's going to protect the rest of the community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's an internal dynamic too. And to not see the connection between three things that we don't talk about: the role of punishment in our families and mm-hmm. communities, and how it plays out and how much black people are killing each other on the street, and how it relates to the attitudes about women in society and our cultural depictions and representations and conversations about women. Mm-hmm. All those things to me are intricately connected to each other in ways that are deep and historical. And you can't really get to the heart of what's going on in our society without grappling with and addressing those things. But they're also the things that people have the most difficulty taking on, because they actually touch us all personally, both in our sense of who we are and our sense of entitlement to what we have.
Deborah followed up by talking about the intricacies of mass criminalization in conjunction with racial oppression.
I mean, I live out here in Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
and I have to tell you, one of the most infuriating things that I experience every single day is the way in which white people automatically clutch their purse as soon as they see you coming within 5 feet of them.
Mm-hmm.
It just drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. Because I'm like, really? You guys have hundreds of years of exploiting and stealing from black people, of taking everything we've ever gotten, and you have it that we're the thieves? Seriously, I mean, honestly, it just drives me crazy. And that's same conversation I have about white fear. Mm-hmm. For me, it lives inside the space of projection mm-hmm. that all white Americans live in. Mm-hmm. I'm serious about this. Mm-hmm. Because underneath everything, whether you consider yourself a progressive or not, mm-hmm. there is an element of being a white American that requires you to project mm-hmm. your own actions or the historical actions, attitudes on other people, mm-hmm. and particularly on people of color. It's like the idea that we have a national conversation in which white people feel that they have a legitimate right to be afraid of black people, particularly black men, even though they're the ones right. who spent several hundred years killing us, mm-hmm. lynching us, mm-hmm. shooting us on sight for any reason, raping our women and taking our kids and mm-hmm. selling them away. Mm-hmm. And yet they still feel like they have a right to claim fear of the black man and use that as a legitimate defense to any time that they kill us now.
Right. Yeah. That's the other thing. It's one thing to think about it historically, but then to think about the continued means of attack by white folks on black life up until this present moment. It'd be one thing if this was just in the past, but it's here with us right now. But yet there's still this fear of clutching purses or locking doors, etc.
And partly this goes back to what you were saying at the beginning, which is interesting, is that the fear itself is deeply embedded in those attacks. So like the fear itself is part and parcel of the attack. So it's the projection drives that.
So I'm afraid of you, so therefore I will actually attack you before you can attack me, when there is no evidence that the white person was going to be attacked in the first place.
That's exactly right. And, or that person was even paying any attention.
Right.
And yet where I fault black people is that the only time that we do or say anything about it is when there's a dead body of something mm-hmm. we can claim might be innocent. You know, so mm-hmm. my challenge to us is mm-hmm. like, suppose Trayvon Martin had been carrying a dime bag and a blunt
right.
instead of a can of soda and a Skittles. He would have been equally dead. Mm-hmm. But would black folks have been as willing to go out and protest for him?
Right.
You know, I don't see the death of Romali Graham in the Bronx,
right.
who shot in his bathroom,
right.
flushing down a bag of weed by the cops who chased him in there, having anywhere near the kind of national significance as the Trayvon Martin case. And to me, it has everything to do with the fact that he had marijuana, like for real.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that in our community, we're still into this visual politics of respectability.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so we'll defend the respectable black people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
right.
we won't defend the ones who can in any way be labeled as criminal, even though the labeling of our kids as criminal starts when they're as young as in kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this politics of respectability has anything to do with the relationship between those who are incarcerated and the larger black community outside? I was at an event for the lifers and long-termers at Shawangunk this past weekend. One of the brothers stated that it's a shame that the people who support us are primarily white. And he said that, you know, he said, for instance, the two most active denominations the primary one he mentioned was the Presbyterians. And, you know, to think that, you know, the majority of black folks are not Presbyterian, more of them are closely connected to the Baptist tradition, but yet they have no prison outreach ministries. They're not trying to be connected with the larger incarcerated community. So I guess the question is, does that politics of respectability impact how the larger black community treats those who are incarcerated and interacts with them while they are incarcerated, and even when they get out?
Absolutely, yes. And I mean, that was one of the things I really liked about Khalil Muhammad's book,
mm.
because he really talked about that in The Condemnation of Blackness. I like to call those people the Black Victorians. You know, they're sort of the keepers of the moral sanctity of the community. And, you know, they've been there in every generation, including the current one. But the other part of that, which is you know, because I don't want to just blame people.
Right.
The other part of that has to do with the fact that our religious expression in the U.S. of black people, at least for the black people who consider themselves Christian, which is the majority of black people,
right,
is based on a Southern religious tradition. And the Southern religious Christian tradition is particularly a punitive one.
Mm.
Because it was designed to serve the hierarchical punitive system of slavery.
Mm. Wow.
And so unlike Northern Christianity, of which you had more Presbyterians, etc.,
mm-hmm.
who were not necessarily having to have the church be in service of this hierarchical system,
mm-hmm.
you had much more progressive movements coming out of the church
mm-hmm.
in Northern and Midwestern areas than you did in the South. And to this day, the expression of Southern Christianity continues to be more fundamentalist, more punitive,
yeah.
more hierarchical
right.
in ways that reinforce not just racism, but sexism
mm.
and misogyny, because it's built on top of mm. and in service of this hierarchical system of slaveocracy.
Mm.
And so to the degree that when black folks migrated, they migrated with that.
Mm.
You know, and most black people still belong to those Southern
mm.
denominations that maintain those very fundamentalist punitive traditions. And so that's mm. one of the reasons why I told you, Alexandra,
mm-hmm.
that for me, one of the most important areas of work
mm-hmm.
within the black community is for us to actually begin to distinguish our continuing relationship to punishment and the dysfunctional
yes.
nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the connective tissue to all of the criminal justice issues that impact us. And it's the one that we're most deeply ingrained with because of its relationship to the church and spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And so to some degree, there has to be an ability of people to understand the ways in which the Southern Baptist tradition influences our attitudes about punishment
mm-hmm.
in such a way that we can begin to distinguish it.
We're talking with Deborah Small, a lawyer and activist who has worked in the field of criminal justice reform for 15 years, who contrasts the Southern Christian fundamentalist punitiveness with what she refers to as a paradigm of reform based on love.
And so I believe that we can have the same kind of breakthrough in distinguishing mm-hmm. our relationship to punishment, but we have to actually see that it's dysfunctional and recognize that whatever value it may have served in helping us to cope with the vagaries of slavery and Jim Crow justice, that it's outlived its usefulness.
Mm-hmm.
And as crazy as it may sound, my mantra and my mission is for us to totally replace the punishment paradigm with a paradigm based on love.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that love has a much better power, ability to transform people and heal them,
mm-hmm.
even from the worst behavior, than punishment does. And I know that that's considered a radical idea in our society.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not in and of itself radical, because it actually works. So my hope is that 100 years from now,
mm-hmm.
we'll be at a place that we no longer punish people when they transgress, that we actually employ the use of healing circles and healing spaces as a way to shift behavior. Because the reality is that people respond to positive reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wants love. That's part of being a human being. And the more damaged a person is, the more love they need to heal them, mm-hmm. not punishment.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on, actually.
This portion of our interview with Deborah Small has covered the historical, social, and political context of mass criminalization in America. Her utilization of mass criminalization to frame this discussion has created a number of questions that we intend to engage in future shows. They include the school-to-prison pipeline, preventing decarceration from turning into a process for the further criminalization and net widening within the criminal justice system, the gendered nature of crime and punishment, and what strategies we can develop to resist mass criminalization.
We enjoyed talking with Deborah Small and suggest our listening audience to read her work on Salon.com, critiquing the focus of both conservatives and progressives on incarceration over and above the worrying trend of mass criminalization.
Listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. And I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm I could live like I